Everyone, my name is Boaz Wachtel. I'm from Israel. I've been working with Howard and Norma since the 1988, I think, we started doing the treatments. And also with iCash, with Bob Sisco. And I've been involved intensively for 5 years, from 1988 to 1993, with the shuttle of addicts from the United States to the Netherlands. And also we did some work together in Panama. And at the same time, I was trying to help get the Ibogaine clinical trials going in Israel. And it's been taking much longer than, as always, much longer than we thought, requiring greater resources than we had. That's why the slow pace of the clinical development in Israel. And I did some treatments. Don't tell anybody. I did some Ibogaine treatments in Israel, but deep underground, because we didn't want to endanger the clinical development track in Israel. I still do treatments from time to time. We fly them to Holland, and luckily we found some doctors who are willing to take charge. And that was our dream from the beginning, that we will have a semi or fully chemical clinical environment, so the patients will be safe. I'm coming from the point where the safety of the patient is the primary concern for me, and the outcome is a secondary. Yes. A few years ago, Howard and I, okay. Let's start the presentation. Okay. So this is a picture. Most of the pictures I took, but it doesn't matter really. Everybody knows what this is. Heroin on a aluminium foil. This is the outcome, not necessarily of this chasing the dragon. This in New York, in the Lower East Side, where I used to hang out also. Pretty much, and one day I went to, I was waiting for Bob Sisco, and I went to the backyard in front just to pee because it was a cold day, and I found this couple during a heroin overdose, were lying there, and I called the ambulance. It was a horrible scene. The guy died, she made it somehow. And if I was maybe, I don't know, 5 minutes late or something, she wouldn't have made it as well. We're talking about, of course, a very serious problem of drug abuse. This just happened to be an American slide. I don't have an American bias, even though I lived in America for 12 years. But if you multiply it around the world, these are similar ratios, the cost of substance abuse to society. Smoking, illegal drugs, and alcohol. What's amazing in this slide is that alcohol costs more to society, which is a illegal drug, costs more to society than the illegal drugs or the smoking per se. Now, NIDA found that in 1992, the total economic cost of alcohol and drug abuse was $245 billion. 97 of that was due to drug abuse. The estimate includes substance abuse treatment and prevention costs, as well as other health care costs, costs associated with reduced job productivity or lost earnings, and other costs to society such as crime and social welfare. Study also determined that these costs are borne primarily by the government, 46%, followed by those who abuse drugs and members of the household, 44%. So the 1992 cost estimate has increased. We're talking about many years ago, but I couldn't find an update for some reason at the NIDA website. Maybe it is a intentional, because they don't want to show that they are able, with their prohibition policies, to reduce the cost to society. And they didn't want to make a slide showing their failure over time. So the 92 cost estimate increased over 50% from the 85 one, and the four primary contributors to the increase were the epidemic of cocaine use, HIV epidemic, an eightfold increase in state and federal incarceration for drug offenses, and a threefold increase in the crimes attributed to drugs. More than half the estimated cost of drug abuse were associated with drug-related crime, meaning that if you distribute heroin, for example, you can reduce that portion of the cost to society tremendously. Lost productivity of victims and incarcerated perpetrators of drug-related crime, 20%, and so on. We can see low below that the White House ONDCP, where the drugs are, the famous drugs, the Americans are in love with czars. Now they have a war czar for Afghanistan and Iraq. They never had a peace czar for some reason. Conducted a study to determine how much money is spent on illegal drugs that otherwise would support legitimate spending on saving. And they found that Americans spend 53, these are 99 figures from 88 to 95. I mean, you can bet your life that these figures have tripled or quadrupled since. Americans spend $57 billion on drugs, broken down at $38 billion on coke, $9.6 on heroin, $7 billion on cannabis, and $2.7 billion on other illegal drugs. It's a lot of money. Now we go to the main issue. Everybody knows this slide, or it's from Arrowhead. I didn't write it, but it's a timeline of ibogaine, 1864. First report of use of tabanenda iboga as a stimulant and aphrodisiac in Gabon and Congo. That's 150 years ago or so. 1889, the genus Tabanenta iboga is established, and the botanical description is made by Henry Bellion at the Museum of National Natural History in Paris. 1901, iboga and first isolated. 1903, first report of cultural use of Tabanenta iboga as a visionary plant in Congo. 1939, the extract was started to be sold under Lambert-Rain. It was mentioned before. 1962-63, Howard Latzoff conducted the experiments with ibogaine use with himself and some other folks. 1985, ibogaine patents patent was awarded for heroin addiction. 89, ibogaine added to the list of doping substances banned by the International Olympic Committee. So there's basically an evolution. It's a very interesting evolution to the ibogaine phenomena. It starts here at one with the African use of knowledge, which is hundreds, and as we saw from previously, thousands of years old. And then in the early 60s, we go to the right. It's like a clockwise, lots of anti-addiction discovery in the 60s. And then the underground treatments started from 88, still going on in various parts of the world, underground and above ground. And then the animal studies followed from the 80s, more or less. That's where it really took off. There are now, if you look at the the American Medical Library online, PubMed line, there are almost 300 research papers on ibogaine now. I mean, it's a very researched substance now. And then semi-clinical settings, the work with Bastians that I will talk about, and we are waiting, of course, the launching of clinical trials that will finally get ibogaine approved as a medication according to the very high standards and exaggerated standard sometimes in the Western world and the FDA. This slide, I think, is was taken by Dan Lieberman, who unfortunately was killed in a car accident in South Africa. He was an ethnobotanist. It's, on the right, there's an ibogaine in the bush, and the flower on the left, and the molecule, and the beautiful ceremony that is taking place over there. This slide also by Dan Lieberman of Beauty Initiates. of the Misoko Gonde initiation. That is a slide of more or less the spectrum of influence, if you will, of the Iboga culture in Western Africa. Cameroon, Ecuador, Guinea, Gabon, Republic of Congo, Central Africa, Uganda, Rwanda, Democratic Republic of Congo, and Burundi. Now we have a few psychiatrists in the audience, but this is a very interesting slide that was made by Fernandez. The N is the number of people that he interviewed, and nine of them, which is 24%, saw nothing and heard nothing, and eight heard many voices, great Talmud, recognized the voices of ancestors and saw nothing, had no visualization. That's 21%. Three heard and saw various of my ancestors. They walked with me and introduced and instructed me on my life in the Bwiti and elsewhere. That's 34%. And four, which is 21%, I walked over or flew over a long multicolored road over many rivers, which led me to my ancestors, who then took me to the great gods. Now, these are visions or experiences from Africa. What's fascinating is the correlation between these visions, and everybody knows Howard Lotsoff, of course, who's here. Where is our Howard? he went for lunch. he's a mentor of mine in activism and one of my mentors, my men that I've learned so much from. So if we compare the previous slide, the phases of the Ibogan experience with the stages that we see here in the West, so we read it, it's a lot of text, but it's worth reading. The Ibogan experience has been described as being characterized by three distinct phases, as Howard defined them in 1995, that's with the publication. The onset of the effect progressed gradually. The first phase, after taking Ibogaine, which lasts about an hour, the visual and the physical the perception of the body change. From patients suffer, some patients suffer from lowered coordination ability and feel the need to lie down. The second phase, 1 to 7 hours, is often called the waking dream state. The patients lie down and usually are overwhelmed by the effects of the experience. Hallucinations, emotion, change in perception. This is especially important for people who've never done Ibogaine treatments, okay? Because this is typical of what people feel, and patients feel heavy physically and experience difficulties when trying to move. This is the ataxia that is associated with Ibogaine. Ataxia is the difficulty to move, and it's very important when you do Ibogaine treatment, when someone wants to go to the toilet and so forth, to help them so they don't fall down and knock themselves on the sink or something like this. It's a transient ataxia. It passes after the after a few hours or a few days, depending on your recovery rate. The hallucinations include, among other things, the following scenes: hearing African drums, seeing TV screens, animals decreased, and animals decreased, deceased people who often took a look alive and approach the person, tell them something, and disappear again. That's common, of course, with the African visions, flying above oceans, cities, woods, traveling through their own brain or DNA, seeing objects in intensive colors, scenes of violence, etc. In spite of the strong hallucinogenic effects, the patients are able to exit them by opening their eyes, yes? So if you're under the influence of Ibogaine, it's not like maybe classic hallucinogenic drugs, that you say, hey, man, are you with us? And they are totally gone. With Ibogaine, they open their eyes. Takes them, you know, a few seconds, but then they can concentrate and you can relate to them. Our approach has always been, let them do the work themselves. Let the people do the work themselves with Ibogaine. Don't, how do you feel so much? And this, you know, you ask them from time to time and see, and we'll talk about the monitoring soon, but the molecule does the job so well that really, and since I'm not a psychiatrist or a psychologist and so forth, if you want deep analysis or discussion and so forth, do it afterwards, after the effects are gone and so forth. and let the molecule do its job. Many patients also report about visions that are characterized by complete stories, which mean something to the subject and help him to achieve certain insights. These visions are often memories or events from early childhood. The insights reached are usually have to do with the subject's past and the meaning of life, the creation and evolution of humanity, the animal world, and the universe. The visions usually end after 3 to 5 hours. So the bottom line in this stage is that we have a common unconscious, all humanity, yes, that Iboguin taps into. So we share the same visions as people in Africa and the people from the Lower East Side or from the Upper East Side or wherever. And it just shows that under the skin we are all the same. That's all. The third phase is often called the cognitive phase in deep introspection, which usually starts 8 to 36 hours after taking Iboguin. It seems that the body is asleep while the spirit is fully awake. This phase is characterized by the intellectual evaluation of early experiences in life and the choices made. For instance, if a certain choice seemed as the only solution at this point, the subject discovers in third phase that there were other alternatives. After the end of the third phase, the subject finally falls asleep for several hours. Often the need to sleep is temporarily reduced after an Iboguin experience, a situation that can last from 1 month or even longer. This, okay. Now, from the experience that we have, it appears that the most effective treatment involves visionary doses of Iboguin that produce an interruption of opiate craving and appetite, intensive counseling therapy during the interruption period, the window of opportunity when the metabolite does its work, and maintaining a healthy lifestyle and occupation. Many subjects or patients after the Iboguin treatment suddenly are looking to get in touch with nature. It's a fabulous phenomena. They're looking to go to walk to a park. These are urban, many of them are just urbanites, you know, and they want to be close to nature. So give them the opportunity to be close to nature and connect. It helps them reconnect with themselves. Few patients require a second and third session over the course of the next 12 to 18 months to completely rid themselves of opiate addiction. A minority of patients relapse into opiate addiction. Now, lack of standards. Here we go into the safety issue. Lack of standards cause unqualified people to open Iboguin clinic. The legal status of Iboguin caused many treatment providers to work underground without proper medical knowledge, facilities, or the ability to maintain high treatment standards. 1. Pre-treatment. It must include screening. If you want to save the patient, and if you want to keep on working in the future with Iboguin, you must do proper screening. We'll talk about what kind of screening is involved. The other aspect is a motivational level. Get to know the person behind the addiction. We used to spend 1 or 2 days to meet the people before we took them to the Netherlands. So we can evaluate the level of manipulation, the level of motivation. So it's very important to get to know the person a little bit before you do the treatment. Treatment-wise, provide safe and pleasant environment. Use qualified personnel with experience. 3, the post-treatment, send this person to his or her psychologist or psychiatrist. So it's very important to digest the issues with someone that you have been talking to before. I mean, it's better if we had psychiatrists or psychologists or support groups who specialize on Iboguin, but it's not the case usually. So try to form support group, let's say in London or in New York. So get the people together to talk about this shared experience. It's very important. Make yourself available on the phone, online for consultation support. Maintaining medical standards for each stage alongside compassion are the foundation of good work with Iboguin. Now we talk about the inclusion and exclusion criteria with Iboguin. One of the things that must be done is echocardiogram, EKG, under stress, because Iboguin puts the heart under stress. Must be giving an EKG, at least an EKG, but it's better to do it under stress. It also must be analyzed by a cardiologist, not just a regular doctor, in order to see if it stands the stress. NIDA, in their Ibogaine protocol, which has been criticized to be too restrictive, set an exclusion criteria for the for at 400% of the normal liver enzyme values. However, the core safety issue is cardiac health. Further, the patients must be under continuous cardiac monitor with particular attention directed to the prolonged QT interval. Cardiologists should be included if possible. Not everyone can hire a cardiologist, but at least a doctor with a cardiology, a knowledge in cardiology should be included as part of the core medical staff. I'm talking about clinics. This is not the do-all and end-all, but the best effort analysis. Now, because the safety is a primary issue, in 2003, Howard, it was mostly Howard, I have to give him the credit who wrote the manual. I helped with what I could. We wrote this screening, safety, monitoring, and aftercare. If anybody wants to launch Ibogaine treatment facility or underground or what have you, you must look at this manual. It includes all the aspects of Ibogaine treatment. Treatment, intake, safety issues, dose, effects, opiate, withdrawal, so forth. You must study this for the sake of the patient safety and so forth. It's online at ibogaine.org. Okay? Intake procedure. Many individuals have been doing detox work not according to standard modern medicine security measures. Interview the patient. Know his medical history. Get a general physician report. Look at the report. What kind of medications he was on. We're talking about people's life here. And if he's using medications, there could be interactions between Ibogaine and other medications that should be avoided. And find out the level of self-motivation. Many patients come to treatment because the mother wants them to come to treatment, or the girlfriend or the boyfriend. And if the individual does not have high level of motivation, don't treat them, because they will give you trouble. They don't do it for themselves, they do it for the family. I'm talking from experience. Ask about drug use and past treatments. A minimum of ACG under stress, clinical chemical panel, blood, a complete blood count with differential platelets, CBC, HIV blood screen. It doesn't mean that we can't treat people with HIV, but at least know that if this individual is positive or not. Liver count. Exclusion criteria. We won't go into it. You can find it in the Ibogaine manual. But it includes, it must be respected, this inclusion criteria. If there are history of psychosis and bipolar illness and major depression, organic dementia, and some other issues, and so forth. So it must be studied for anybody who wants to. This is another slide of the exclusion criteria. Impaired liver function. If someone has a totally impaired liver function due to alcohol and so forth, if it's 400%, if it's more than 400% of the normal level, don't do it. Inclusion criteria. It should be voluntary, of course. They must sign informed consent. They should do medical evaluation, supply a copy of the medical history, try to give them a back depression so they can follow the improvement in the depression at later stages, ECG, blood testing, and so forth. Okay? Now, this is a slide. This is from the early days. We had a monitor, two monitors, very primitive. We used to work in two rooms. In one room, the staff was sitting, and the other room was the patient. It's audio-visual. I mean, I recommend you use higher monitors these days, because this is like almost a camera monitor. I mean, it's not. But that's what the money we had for the other days. Also, we is a gender issue here. This is also from who wrote this, Guderell. And he's quoting about the African experience, that the women take iboga in smaller quantities than the ones taking in the iboga in the Bwiti initiation. In their case, the visions do not go beyond the third fluid stage, during which Jenny's good or evil communicate to the woman that they are in possession of the causes of the affliction or illness for which they are consulted. Women, in my no one has done a study on the difference of iboga and how iboga is affecting men and women differently. It must be done at some point. I mean, I don't know who's going to do it, and so yes. No relevant data, no published data, no one. So to take a precautionary road is, in my view, is to give women less than you would give men. It's also true in many types of alcohol, for example, women are more susceptible to alcohol than men are. So if you extend this rationale, so give them less than you would to men. Now, this is a list of needs for the anti-addiction treatment with ibogaine. The location is very important. A successful location may reduce the need for future pre-treatments. The two main requirements are that it has to be quiet, and you can darken the room. You have curtains that you can shut. Not far from hospital, that's another recommendation. If something happens, you'll be close by. Check location, go into the location, into the hotel. If you're doing it in a hotel, check it before you start the treatment. Ask if there are any construction going on, because a hammer, a mechanical or pneumatic hammer, when you're doing an ibogaine treatment and it happened a few times, can totally fuck up the treatment. Get medical supervisor approval of the location. Of course, it's always the best to do the ibogaine treatment with a doctor. But if you don't have a doctor, whatever medical authority, if there is one, have them also have their say. If you are just the coordinator, check isolation from sound. Buy earplugs. If you got problems with the sound, it's better to use earplugs and eye covers. Use double bed, not a single bed. It's better so they can stretch from to different directions, because we're talking about 24, 36 hours lying in bed. Have light next to bed to view the instrument reading. When you come and check the individual every 10 minutes or so forth, you must have good readings. Have a chair next to it to make sure there's enough room next to the bed on the floor. If something happens and you have to resuscitate someone and to do cardiac massage, you don't do it on bed. You do it on the floor, because you need a hard floor. Other issues. Have two cameras, one right on top of the individual with sound. Every camera must have a sound, and then another one from further back to have a full body view. Do audiovisual tests. Make sure the patient cannot reach the camera from the bed, because many patients sometimes they feel the privacy is being infringed and they try to either cover it and so forth. Be aware of it so they don't reach the camera. Near the bed, place for water. Make sure subject drink at least 2 liters of water. Otherwise, they will dehydrate, which is not very good. Prepare a bucket right next to the bed and towels. Clothes ready, just in case. Remove all patient's possessions. This is one very important issue, ladies and gentlemen. Remove access to their possessions. All the clothes that bags and so forth, they should not have access during, because if they feel they're going to withdraw and they miss the heroin and they find the heroin close by, that's it. I mean, everybody's in deep trouble. So it's your responsibility to make sure to remove all their positions. We're not into the issue doing full body search, because they can hide, of course, whatever they want in different locations in the body, but still, ask them, and they have to be fair with you. Ask them to take a shower before the treatment begins so they feel clean. Write down the phone number of local ambulance service or address of hospitals to be ready-made. Have a map if you're an outsider. Have ahead of time, prepare a list of medication and drugs patients consume in the last 3 to 4 days prior to treatment and short history of drug abuse. Have the test results ready. Evechat, an automatic instrument ready for blood pressure and heartbeat reading. Today you have very advanced things you can put in the finger. It gives you blood pressure and heart rate. Yeah. Yeah. Just a saturation. No, I saw one already that gives you a
lecture of blood pressure.
Yeah. Make room in chat for remarks. Now, the other hints and needs for anti-addiction treatment with ibogaine. Stop any drug taking the night before. If you can stop it before, you can do it 20, 24, 30 hours before. It's great, but it's, of course, it's not always the case. Reduce other drug taking on the days leading to the treatment. Perform a drug throwaway ceremony the evening before. That was Howard and Norma's idea. We did it in the Netherlands the night before. This is the last night I'm going to take drugs. We'll take all the paraphernalia.
I don't need this. Take all the paraphernalia.
It's being recorded. We take all the paraphernalia. We throw it away. It's kind of a ceremony. They have to make a difference between your life until now and your life from now on. Okay. So, and life of an addict is a very ceremonial 5 minutes. Take away all possessions and deny access during treatment. Administer under anti-nausea pill prior to the treatment. Why the anti-nausea pill? Because if you start throwing after you take ibogaine, you don't know how much ibogaine you got in your system. So the nausea, the anti-nausea, helps you keep the ibogaine for as long as possible. Give 100 milligram test dose 2 hours before the treatment. After treatment, take subjects close to nature as much as possible. The reading, sit down next to the patient for the first 2 or 3 hours. That's my belief. Don't go to the other room and come back every 10 minutes, because in these 10 minutes, things can go wrong. Sit down in the same room, and then afterwards, at 2 or 3 meters, view and listen to breathing patterns, take readings every 10 minutes in the first 2 hours, 3 or 4 hours, every 15 minutes, and so forth. Treatment team room, connecting door must be between the rooms, and then so forth, small kitchen. That's basic stuff there for the staff. Now, when you do treatments, I know many people, especially in the underground, I mean, this is like a dream if I would have a defibrillator and a monitor and so forth. But this is something to aspire. You understand? And these things can be rented, okay? Relatively easy these days. And even if you have a medic, yeah? Even if he's not qualified, these instruments can be relatively easy to understand how to use them with the instrument. The resuscitator is very important, of course. Stretcher, first aid kit. If you have a doctor, that's, you know, half God for us. It was always to have a doctor. Doctor case, 1 and 2. Telephones and come a car if needed. I won't go into this. This is the withdrawal signs that you see, that most of the withdrawal signs are eliminated with ibogaine. That's the beauty of ibogaine, I think, and it is striking for people who've done detoxes, cold turkey or other methods. Ibogaine is a very humane way to detoxify from opiates. Now we run, Howard, don't worry, I'm almost done. We'll just run quickly on a few pictures from that time. A common living conditions in Rotterdam, that's where for weeks at a time we used to work in a flat. It was very damp and so forth. This is what you see in the monitor. Yes, downstairs in the part below. This is a woman being treated, and Howard being interviewed by ABC News, who was trying to check. They said, "What's the story about ibogaine? It sounds too good to be true. It's maybe a hoax or something." So they followed 3 patients, pre and post. Yes, and eventually they had a very good report on us. So this is in Leiden. Howard calculating dosage, and another picture from the monitor. This is iCash. iCash was basically Bob Sisco and me and maybe one or two other people. And NDA was Howard and Noma and a few other people. And that was, it's not like, you know, General Motors or anything, NDA International. We worked, this is also a beautiful picture of that time, Howard and Sisco during a treatment in Rotterdam. And we did a lot of treatments in a lot. We did some treatments in Novo Hotel in Amsterdam. It's a pink orange hotel. That's where I did my ibogaine in that room, so I took a picture of that. Always seek local support. Have local people who know the area who can tell you where is what. Typical hangout in Amsterdam with the squatters. We went to the lower picture, as you see, is how addicts view their addiction as basically death. Here you see from left to right, it's Howard, and then in the Dr. Bastian's in the center, and Norma and Nico Adrias, who was a true social medical pioneer in the Netherlands, who was the founder of the Junkie Bond in the Netherlands. And the right is Jolich, who did the first animal study, right, Howard? The first animal study with the mice and the morphine, right? That's Jolich. And that's three of us. That's Gerta Frank, who did a lot of good work in the Rotterdam and Howard and Norma. And what you're seeing here is the first is the Deborah Mash on the left. The first phase of the clinical trial, the University of Miami, with the FDA approval, was, as they said, it stopped. And that's the first urine sample that they took very proudly. And ibogaine is not just addiction treatment. It's a whole worldview, a progressive worldview that includes harm reduction and activism and human rights and progressive drug policy. That's the kind of people who've done ibogaine. Here is Dana. On the side when he still had long hair. And this is Nico that sadly died from AIDS. But Nico gave ibogaine to a few people. And it became like a wildfire in Rotterdam among the addicts community. That is Professor Jan Bastians, who was working with us all that time. And it ibogaine made it to JAMA and a few other major papers or a magazine, medical magazine. It's the most important medical magazine in the world, JAMA. I'd like to share with you the last 2 minutes, Howard. I have an extension, 2 minutes. Thank you. Daniel Waterman wrote a story about entheogens. Yes? Am I saying it right? Entheogens. And he didn't write very well about ibogaine. So I said, let me write about the ibogaine part because he's an ayahuasca guy. So this is what I wrote. Even by itself, a millennium of sacramental indigenous use of ibogaine in Africa is a sound enough foundation for the safety and high efficacy claims made by the proponents and users of ibogaine. That is true for other sacraments as well. The evidence of the therapeutic effects of ibogaine and for social medical improvements across few cultures is therefore well established by now and supported with data obtained from thousands of addiction treatments worldwide. Outlawing the sacramental use of foreign entheogens for adults by any society is an act of cultural ignorance and racial supremacy of the highest order. Historically speaking, all the might and services of colonial Christian or Muslim missionaries in Western Africa were not sufficient to conquer the place at heart that ibogaine gained among the Bwiti worshippers of the holy tree of life, as they call it, a key to harmony with nature, oneself, and the past. Denying people access to entheogens can be explained, maybe, with the desire of governments to monopolize the consciousness of people so behavior of the masses can be predicted under conditions of control. Monotheistic religions, instincts to suppress competition, and the strength of their opposition to non-abstinence-based faith certainly influence the will of governments to allow sacred plant science. Ibogaine-related research stands out in the entheogens history because its efficacy, especially for the anti-addiction indications, has been scientifically measured both in animals and users. And the last slide. Freeing the Western mind from the government/media control and dictated consciousness and from the side effects of the toxic legal and illegal drug industries is a task in hand. Imported entheogens or plant teachers are viewed as threat by the American formulated UN conventions because they promote peace, communal and personal awakening, and the preservation of nature. These traits directly conflict with economic forces benefiting from Western government's love affair with abstinence-based monotheistic belief systems, endless industrial growth, and the preservation of the prison industrial complex. Thank you very much.
Thank you. We're running late for lunch now, which is on the ground floor. So if you will all proceed to the breakfast restaurant downstairs. What's that? Okay. Excellent. So let's go have lunch.